Speaking on this program is Brother Winfred Clark.
I want to read for your consideration tonight, beginning with Matthew 12:34. Matthew 12:34. O generation of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Whatever we say, good or bad, comes from our hearts. A good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth good things, and an evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart brings forth evil things. But I say unto you, that every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give an account thereof in the day of judgment. For by thy words thou shalt be justified, and by thy words thou shalt be condemned. When we speak of sins of the mouth, or the tongue, as Jesus has just done, and as James does extensively in James 3, we most often think of lying, or flattery, or gossip, or backbiting. I do not mean to leave the impression that these are not serious sins. They are. They destroy people's reputations. They injure families and churches. Many churches are filled with people who cannot keep their mouths shut at the right time. And so they do great damage with their tongues. But we need to realize that we can do great harm also by not speaking. What would have happened to the people of God had not Esther pled their cause before King Ahasuerus? The people were destined to be killed by Haman, the plot that he had hatched against God's people. And for what reason, I do not know, except perhaps they were God's people. But Esther spoke up. The Bible says that maybe she was raised up for such a time as that. There are evils in our generation. You and I know that. I have spoken of some today. You read about them daily, regularly, in the papers, in magazines, in books. Are we going to sit idly on the sidelines and let the world determine the course of the church and of the nation? Or are we going to speak up and speak out? Representative Henry Hyde from the state of Illinois, a Roman Catholic representative to the United States House of Representatives, a very staunch opponent of abortion, infanticide, euthanasia, very strongly pro-life, has written a book that he calls for every idle silence. I read to you where Jesus said, for every idle word men shall speak, they shall give an account thereof in the day of judgment. Representative Hyde says, and I agree, that for every idle silence, we also shall give an account. Dr. John R. W. Stott, an English theologian, has a little book which he calls The Guilty Silence of the Church. He was not talking about what I'm discussing with you tonight. He was saying that God has given us His Word, which is the power of God unto salvation. Yet many of us are not out teaching people. We're not speaking for Christ. We are keeping the gospel within our church buildings and not reaching the world for Jesus Christ. The church is guilty before God because we are not sharing the gospel. We are not proclaiming it to the whole world. But we can apply that term also to our silence and our indifference and our unconcern about many other issues within our communities. I know what is happening in Memphis, not only because Molly and I lived here when I was a student at the graduate school, but because I read the Commercial Appeal. I watch the news primarily on Channel 5, but occasionally on Channel 3. I know some of the issues that you face with regard to pornography and topless dancing and murder and many, many other problems. What are you doing about it? Are you using your voice, your vote, your influence to make the city of Memphis a better community? Frankly, when Molly and I lived here, we were both concerned about crime. Because on the campus at Harding Graduate, we had students actually beaten up, and there were other crimes. Molly had her car sitting out in the parking lot at Harding Graduate. somebody came on that parking lot at night, undid the nuts on the front wheels, and removed the front wheel, tires and all. We called the police, and that's been 11 years ago or 13 years ago, and they haven't come yet. So we went downtown and told the police that we had had some car wheels stolen. They wrote out a report. We gave it to our insurance company. They don't know whether we were lying or not. You have moral problems. And you're not all that different from other cities. In fact, you are much better along that line than some others I could mention. Murder capital of the world is our national capital, Washington, D.C. We have problems, ladies and gentlemen. We have issues to face. We can make a difference because silence can be guilty. There are a great number of issues I'd like to discuss with you. Incidentally, I have noticed some of our brethren saying that those of us who preach ought not to discuss issues. But I happen to disagree with that. Actually, they are discussing the issue of not discussing issues. But we will talk about some of them tonight. And I do not preach like this all the time. I do mostly expository preaching. But I do want to alert you to some of the problems, which I'm sure many of you already know, and tell you some of what we can do about it. I'm not going to do this in any particular order except the order that I have in my mind. But let me talk first about beverage alcohol. I made a vow to my Lord years and years ago, about 40 to be exact, that I would not preach long, either on radio or in the pulpit, without talking about the dangers of beverage alcohol. The reason is I have seen what it does to families and to individuals. We were talking at lunch today. My grandfather Claiborne was an alcoholic, a very intelligent man, but an alcoholic. My grandpa Dillahay, a Dutchman, and I'm about half Dutch, was a drunk. And there is a difference between the two. He would get drunk about every 2 years, but he was not an alcoholic. I know what alcohol does to families. And with God's help, I am not going to preach for any congregation or long on radio or elsewhere without telling people what alcohol does to families and to individuals. You used to have a physician here in the city of Memphis by the name of Joel Fort. Dr. Ford is a specialist in the area of drugs, alcohol, marijuana in particular. He wrote a book in 1971 that he called Alcohol, Our Biggest Drug Problem. Many of us hear on television and on radio, and we read in papers, that we have a drug problem in the United States, which all of us know. We talk about cocaine and the heroin, and PCP, and LSD, and many, many other kinds of dangerous drugs. Incidentally, we also have a problem with prescription drugs. Many of us are hooked on prescription drugs, for which we can blame not only ourselves, but our physicians as well. But Dr. Ford says the biggest drug problem we have, the most dangerous drug we use, is alcohol. He establishes that by a number of lines of reasoning. For example, he says, that alcohol is more dangerous than the other drugs that I have mentioned. In fact, all of them combined, except tobacco, because it kills more people than all of these other drugs. About 2,000 people die in the United States every year because of cocaine. 2,000. That, dear friends, is tragic. About 2,000 die because of overuse of heroin, and about 2,000 from PCP and LSD and other dangerous drugs. That's 6,000 people. But do you know how many die from alcohol abuse? 25,000 on our highways alone, and many thousands in industrial accidents, plus heart attacks, high blood pressure, cirrhosis of the liver. Altogether, 200,000 people. Why does not television tell us how dangerous alcohol is? You seldom hear that. But these other drugs are dangerous, and we have a program saying, just say no. And I agree with that. But let's put alcohol in that category also. Let us say no to alcohol. Alcohol also is dangerous, Dr. Ford says, because of its addictiveness. It's the most addictive drug that human beings use, except for tobacco. And I do want to emphasize that 400,000 people die every year from smoking and using tobacco. But you don't hear much about that anymore. Although fewer people are smoking in the United States today than probably ever in the history of this country. That's a good sign. But many of them turn from tobacco to marijuana or alcohol or other drugs. So we are not out of the woods as yet. But alcohol is extremely addictive. And here's the tragedy. Nobody knows when he starts to drink alcohol, when he will become addicted, or even if he will become addicted. There are people that drink 20 years, 25 years, and never really become addicted. But then all of a sudden a man loses his wife, or his child, or his business, and he turns to alcohol as comfort, and he becomes an alcoholic. It is tremendously deceptive. Now there is a way never to be addicted, never to be captured by alcoholism, and there is only one way, and that is to leave it alone. There is no other way. Years ago, Shakespeare said that we put a substance into our mouths, meaning strong drink, that takes away our brains. That, dear friends, is exactly what alcohol does. There are men that behave in abominable ways, and then they try to excuse it by saying, "But I was drinking." Incidentally, there is a new book that I hope you will purchase and read by Bob Stewart. It is about Frank and Elizabeth Morris, who are members of the body of Christ in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. They had only one son, an 18-year-old freshman at David Lipscomb College. You may have read about this in the Reader's Digest. A drunk ran over that son and killed him. And they were angry. I can understand that. In fact, Elizabeth Morris said, "I would like to get him standing against a tree and drive my automobile into him." I can understand that. But then she forgave Tommy Pigage. They took him into their home. He is a very close friend. He travels with them, talking about the evils of alcohol. And I wish we could go on. One of my greatest concerns about alcohol, not only that it destroys the body and the mind and the soul, but it influences families in detrimental ways. Let me talk just briefly about gambling also. Incidentally, the pamphlet that you have at front, written by Garland and Brother Robert Taylor, is worth its weight in gold. If you have not read it, if you've not gotten it, I encourage you to do it. Because you need to know, we are about to face a problem in the state of Tennessee. There is agitation right now to legalize lottery in the great state of Tennessee. It will take your voice and the voices of all concerned Tennesseans to keep our legislators, some of your own in Memphis, from passing the law and hurting families and individuals and the state. Brother Elkins and Brother Robert Taylor say in that pamphlet that gambling brings in crime. And it does. But dear friends, gambling is crime. It is dangerous. It destroys families because it takes money that little babies need for milk and clothes, and that families need to pay rent and insurance. There are many cases where a man has lost his business, his automobile, his house, and his family because he's addicted to gambling. Gambling is just as addictive as alcohol or marijuana or some of the other drugs, and marijuana may not be quite as addictive as cocaine and heroin. But gambling is addictive. And if you think we can solve our financial problems in Memphis or in the state of Tennessee by lottery, my dear friends, you have another thing coming. We simply cannot do it. And besides, if we could, if it were possible, and in my judgment it is not, it would still be wrong, which is what Brother Elkins wrote in a newspaper article in the Commercial Appeal. I want to spend the rest of our time tonight talking about what are commonly called biomedical or bioethical issues. And these are pro-life issues: abortion, infanticide, euthanasia. I mentioned today that in the United States, in the past 18 years, we have killed 25 million babies. Now, you can use more euphemistic language if you'd like. Try to soften it just a little. But we've killed babies. The Bible calls Jesus, while he was in his mother's body, a brephos. The Greek word brephos, which means child or baby. When he exited his mother's body and they dedicated him at the temple, he is called a child, brephos. The Bible makes no distinction between the baby in his mother's womb and the one outside. Abortion is the most controversial issue our nation has faced probably ever, and certainly since the Vietnam War and since the days of slavery. It has divided communities. It has divided states. It has brought about violence, incidentally, on both sides of the abortion issue. There have been cases, particularly in the state of Florida, where pro-life people have gone into clinics and have bombed them and painted them and used violence to stop violence. Now, I believe in rescuing. That is, I believe in using every legitimate means to keep little babies from being torn into pieces or from being salted and killed in their mother's bodies. I'm against that, and I believe that we as Christians ought to use every legitimate means, even sometimes when they are illegal, in order to achieve that purpose. These are our fellow human beings. One of the leading spokesmen against abortion, and for what reasons I cannot explain to you, is Dr. Bernard Nathanson, and the reason I cannot explain it is because Dr. Nathanson, a Jew, is a convinced atheist. You tell me why an atheist would be against anything, unless he just happened not to like it. But Dr. Nathanson wrote an outstanding book, which he calls Aborting America. He is also the doctor that did the narration on the film The Silent Scream. He has done much good, and I applaud the work that he does. Dr. Nathanson personally aborted 3,000 babies and supervised the aborting of 60,000 more. He operated the largest abortion clinic in the United States. But Dr. Nathanson said, all of a sudden, when I was performing this bloody business, it dawned on me that what I am doing is killing my fellow citizens. And that is exactly what abortion is. I want to make a very simple presentation tonight, which I hope you will never forget. Whatever argument can be used to justify abortion can also be used to justify infanticide and euthanasia. Let me repeat that. Whatever argument, and I think I have read them all, can be used to justify abortion can also be used to justify infanticide and euthanasia. Maybe the term infanticide is not one that you read or hear on a regular basis, but if you think about it, it becomes very plain. It means killing babies after they are born. Would we do that in the United States, kill little babies because they are mentally or physically handicapped, or because we just do not want them? Would we do that? It is a practice that it has an ancient history. It was common among the Chinese 4,000 years ago, and it is again in 1991. The Chinese have a law that no family can have more than one child. So if the parents have a little girl and they want a little boy, and most families do, then they kill the little girl when the boy is born. Infanticide is widespread in China. It was among the Greeks. In fact, men as influential and intelligent as Plato and Aristotle supported abortion and infanticide in order to control the population. They thought they were having a population explosion 2,500 years ago. But they also said that babies that are born to older mothers, by which they meant 35 and up, may not be mentally and physically capable, so they ought to be killed also. Now, these are two of the most intelligent, two of the most influential philosophers, and especially Plato, that ever lived. The Romans also killed little babies. You have read about this in history. When a little girl baby was born and they learned that little girls normally do not make good soldiers, whatever the feminists say in 1991, so they would take these little girls and expose them to the elements that put them out in the forest or in caves. where they could either starve to death or be devoured by wild animals, or even worse, picked up by men who operated houses of prostitution. And when the little girls reached 6 or 8 or 10 years old, they were turned into prostitutes. If babies were born mentally or physically handicapped, then they also were exposed, or if the people just did not want them. This is not a pretty picture. It might give you some insight into why the great Roman Empire, the greatest empire, the strongest military machine on the face of the earth at that time, simply disappeared. But as I mentioned, we could not, surely. A nation of ours, like ours, supposed to be a Christian nation, a compassionate nation, we could not do that, could we? Could we kill little babies? I'm not talking about aborting, although in my opinion there's not that much difference. I mean, could we kill little babies that are born because they have spina bifida? Or because they're Down syndrome or have Huntington's chorea? Could we do that? At the little town of Harvey, Illinois, which is not too far from Peoria, a little boy was born to a veterinarian, a doctor, and his wife. The doctor had not seen the child, but after the mother gave birth to it, he went to the hospital. He looked down into the crib and saw the face of his infant son. He had some problems, including cleft palate. He suffered from a condition known as clenched fist, which can be corrected by surgery. He had other problems. The father reached down into that crib and took that baby boy and beat his brains out on the floor of the hospital in Harvey, Illinois. The hospital personnel called the police and had him arrested. They had a trial. The judge turned him loose. The judge said, "We do not have a law forbidding that in the state of Illinois." No law forbidding murder? We do in Tennessee. Every civilized country does, but they let that doctor go free. While the trial was going on, they called in the neighbors as character witnesses. And these neighbors said, "This doctor is a kind and compassionate and loving man. If you have a pet that is sick, then this doctor will stay up all night to take care of your pet, your dog or your cat or whatever." But he killed his son. You can look at it any way you want to, but he killed his son. And that's not in ancient Greece or Rome or China. That's Harvey, Illinois. A school teacher and his wife had a son in Bloomington, Indiana. The father had been reading about Down syndrome children, commonly called mongolism, although that's not a good term. They're Down syndrome children. When this child was born, he had Down syndrome, but he also had physical problems. He had a condition known as esophageal atresia, which means he had a cul-de-sac in his throat. Food could not pass through, and it would exit either side of his swallowing apparatus, and he would die from pneumonia. The doctor said, "We can perform surgery. Chances are 94% out of 100 that he will get well." The parents said no, because he's Down syndrome. When this hit the news and they called the district attorney, and they even had a trial, they called the judge, and he came down to one of the hospital rooms and had a hearing, and the judge said the parents can do whatever they choose. So it hit the news, television, newspapers, all over the country. Calls poured into Bloomington and said, "We will take that little boy, we'll have the surgery, and we will rear him as our own." George Will, incidentally, has a Down syndrome child. George Will said in one of his columns, "Those people did not want those parents who desperately wanted that little boy to have him. They wanted him dead." Why? What crime had he done? None. They wanted him dead because he was handicapped. One author has written that we are aborting babies and we are looking over into the nursery. He is saying, in effect, abortion leads to infanticide. This little boy in Bloomington, Indiana, called Baby Doe, and I know you read this in the paper, starved to death. Starved to death. Do you know what that means? Oh, when Molly's 5 minutes late with lunch, I say, "Now hurry, I'm starving to death." But I don't look like I'm starving too much. But starving a baby? I mentioned to some of you today that Molly would have come with me tonight, except for Pepe. And in case you don't know who Pepe is, he's the greatest dog in the world. So we didn't want to leave him all day. Didn't have anybody to leave him with, nobody to dog sit. But I'm very fond of that little dog, which I never thought I'd say publicly because I never liked dogs till I was 58 years old and Peppy came to live at our house. And he has me wrapped around his little toe because I do exactly what Peppy wants to do. I can imagine that this little dog would get sick or get injured, and I would have to take him to a veterinarian and tell him to put him to sleep. I never thought I'd say this publicly anywhere in the world, but I would really hurt. Wherever I go, Peppy goes. When I go to my study, he comes and gets right behind my chair because he's hoping I'll take him out. But can you imagine starving a dog to death? Molly says I'm feeding him to death because I feed him. If we have steak, he eats steak. You know, the doctor said don't feed him any junk. Don't feed him any table scraps. I don't feed him table scraps. I feed him steak or chicken, and that's his favorite. But I can't imagine starving Peppy to death or any other animal. But we're not talking about dogs and cats and horses. We're talking about babies. Now, if the baby does not deserve to live for whatever reason, then shoot him. That's what you do to a horse or a dog, or put him to sleep with a lethal injection. Whatever argument you can offer for abortion, you can offer for infanticide. And I'll give you one in just a moment. But you can also offer the same on the other end of the spectrum for old people. If the baby is handicapped and old people become handicapped, and we all do, almost all of us, unless we die before, and if we can kill the baby in his mother's body and the infant who is born with handicaps, why can't we kill old people? Especially those that are permanently comatose, those who are terminally ill, and I know you noticed the vote in the state of Washington on that this past week. Those people had good enough sense to reject it. I'm not sure all states are going to. But many of our old people get in conditions that are very hard for us to take. When a friend of mine said, there's an older woman in the hospital or in the nursing room, nursing home, that I'd like for you to go see. So we drove down to the nursing home. Here was a beautiful older woman, probably 80, lying flat on her back, beautiful gray hair, but has known nothing for years. Nothing. She has three daughters. One comes in the morning and stays till afternoon. And the second one comes in, and then about midnight the third. And they do it every day, 24 hours a day. And they take their mother's hand and they talk to her as if she can hear, and maybe she can. Do you want to go to Bloomington, or rather to Salem, and kill this old woman? Give her a lethal injection? Many of our older people are in nursing homes and hospitals, and they are not going to get well. Their conditions are terminal. All of us are terminal, if you want to look at it from one viewpoint, because none of us are going to make it out of this world alive. But if you can kill the baby in his mother's womb, why not old people? They're not making any contributions. During and before World War II, this was precisely the attitude of Adolf Hitler. There were thousands, and I'm not talking about Jews or Czechs or Poles. I am talking about German citizens. Hitler sent his doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists, medical doctors, to hospitals and nursing homes and asked them to interview and to address the situation to see if these older people are going to get well. And if they are, then feed them and clothe them and give them medicine. But if they're not, then take them to the ovens, the gas chambers. And that's precisely what they did. The Germans killed 275,000 of their own old people. 275,000. We have accused Hitler of being a monster. And he was. But what makes our leaning in that direction better? Now let me repeat the argument. Whatever argument can be offered for abortion, and it can also be offered for infanticide and euthanasia. Euthanasia meaning mercy killing. And it could apply to young people, but we normally apply to older people. There are many arguments that have been used, but let me give you just one. Families often say, especially young unmarried women, I cannot afford this baby. I can hardly make a living for myself, and sometimes there are other children involved. So I cannot afford this baby. And babies are expensive. The experts say that a baby from 0 to 18, or perhaps to college, will cost the average family $100,000. I think that's inflated. But I know it's expensive to have babies. Now, if it's expensive to have the baby, and so we're justified in aborting the baby, and that's one of the arguments being used, then what about the baby that's already born? Will he not be expensive also? And especially if that baby happens to be mentally or physically handicapped. My two sisters who are here tonight and I understand that because we had a sister who was afflicted with polio and died in 1950. I do not know financially what my parents had to pay that house full of children in addition to Nadine. But I know what it cost them emotionally. I cannot prove this, but I would not be surprised that my mother did not die younger than would have been normal because of the enormous burden of taking care of that younger sister. Would they have been justified with all of that house full of children to let this child die or to put her to death? My dad worked as hard, and my mom did, as anybody you've ever known. Dad worked two jobs. We had a farm. I never heard him complain about having to work hard. But if it meant more to take care of that sister, he would have done it. But now, if we can abort babies, why couldn't we take the lives of children like that? Incidentally, she was one of the most delightful and inspiring people you will ever meet on the face of this earth. She did not complain, though at times I know she suffered excruciating pain. But she's made a difference in my life, and I think both Ethel and Laura would agree to that. She made a difference in our lives. Are we going to be so insensitive to the needs and the hurts and the wants of people that we're going to let them die because they'll be expensive? And besides, keeping old people in hospitals and in nursing homes is tremendously expensive. Molly just had surgery here in Memphis at the University of Tennessee Hospital. She was in the hospital 2 days. I am not sure we've seen all the bills yet, but those 2 days will probably run $7,000 to $10,000. It's expensive for us older people as we get older to pay our hospital bills, our doctor's bills. Hitler said the old people in Germany were useless eaters. They were consuming materials that should have been used to win the war. Our old people, many of them, are non-productive. They never will be productive. Now, if we can kill the babies in the womb or out of the womb, why can't we kill the old people? I do not need to tell you that there is a movement to that effect in the United States. Dr. Death, Dr. Kevorkian, is working toward that end. He ought to be put in the penitentiary. I would vote for that. But that is gaining influence in the United States of America. But I'm just one person. What can I do about it? I can speak up on it. But I'm not a preacher or an elder or a leader. I'm not a government official. I'm just a housewife or a farmer. You have any neighbors? You have any friends? Could you tell them your concerns about life? You have a vote. Senator Sasser and Senator Gore are going to be up for election. So are your Memphis representative. You have a voice with your vote. When a man votes for and supports abortion, send him back home, where he won't do as much damage. It does make a difference what his party is. If he is pro-death, not pro-choice, pro-death, then he doesn't deserve to be in the Senate or the House of Representatives, either in Washington or in Nashville. You have a voice. You have a vote. I'd like to close tonight with a statement from the Old Testament. When God had led the Israelites out to begin their new life in the wilderness and finally in the land of Canaan, he said through Moses to the people of Israel, "I'm setting before you this day two ways, a way of life, a way of death." And then the Bible says very tersely, choose life. Choose life. We have a right to life. And if we do not, then the other rights are not important. Choose life. But not just physical life. Choose eternal life. If you're not a child of the living God, you need to choose Jesus Christ because He is the life. He's the only life, the only way that leads to heaven. If you've not made that choice, to confess your faith in Jesus Christ as Lord, to obey the gospel and baptism. When you have obeyed the gospel, your sins are forgiven. You are added to God's family, and you're on your way to heaven. Choose life.